It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin Today is part of a new programming schedule on WPR's statewide network that is called WPR News. If you're looking for WPR music service, you can visit WPR.org/new. And there you can find reorganized schedules and all the signal listings.
You can also listen to WPR News or the music service anytime online. We hope you stay with us on Wisconsin Today for the next hour. And thanks for joining us. And by the way, bookmark WPR.org/Wisconsin Today on your browser. You can see what we have coming up and check out archive conversations and share them with friends and family members. Again, that's WPR.org/Wisconsin Today to keep up with this brand new show.
And we love to hear from you along the way about the show and things that interest you that you want us to pursue. And so you can leave us a message. We would love to hear from you. Leave us a message now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can also shoot us an email.
Now, college financial aid offers are beginning to flow more quickly after a rocky start for families filling out the overhauled federal form called the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid.
According to an update from the U.S. Department of Education, more than 9.7 million FAFSA forms have been submitted for the upcoming academic year, with applications being processed within a handful of days. But new research from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows a big drop in the number of Wisconsin students filling out the FAFSA so far this year. Mark Sommerhauser is communications director and a policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Mark, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's good to be with you, Kate. Thank you for having me.
So walk us through your trend lines. How much have application rates decreased statewide?
Yeah, so we've definitely seen a significant decrease through this point in the cycle. I should clarify that our data is not completely current, but it does go up through about the end of April. And so, you know, as of the end of April, what we were seeing is that FAFSA completion rates here throughout Wisconsin were at about 33.9% so far this year. That's compared to 42.4% at the same point in 2023.
And where did you find those numbers? How did you draw in that information?
So, yeah, that's coming from data that's provided by the U.S. Department of Education, which tracks completion rates on the FAFSA application. And so, you know, as we kind of delved a little more deeply into those data, you know, trying to understand where kind of the, you know, what student populations were impacted, what we did see is that there were declines in completion rates across different schools, different student populations, but really the largest declines we were seeing were at schools with a larger proportion of marginalized students.
A larger proportion of marginalized students. So would this be like first generation college students who might be disproportionately impacted by these issues?
Yeah, so there were kind of three bins that we're looking at here: schools with a greater share of students of color, schools with a greater share of students who are English language learners, in other words, students for whom English is not a first language, and then economically disadvantaged students, which is typically going to align pretty closely with low income, low household income. When we look at schools that fall into one or more of those three buckets, what we see is greater declines in those FAFSA completion rates from last year to this year.
And why is the FAFSA so important? What does filling out the FAFSA help you qualify for?
Yeah, so the FAFSA, you know, is really just kind of a first step for most high school seniors that even if they're not certain that they're going to pursue a college education, even if it's just something that they're kind of exploring, it's typically one of the first things that they would do. They would go through the form, oftentimes with a parent, submitting a lot of information about their family's finances, about, one or more colleges or universities that they're considering. And then essentially what happens is that information goes to the federal government and is then forwarded to whatever colleges or universities the student puts on the application. And the college or university will then take the information and typically, let the student and family know what types of, student aid, whether it's grants, loans, any type of financial aid that they might be eligible for. So it's really the way that students can, find out what types of financial aid packages they might qualify for to attend a college or a university.
And so the form of the FAFSA that was updated and changed, it debuted in December. What issues have students been facing in submitting their new FAFSA applications here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, that's correct. And the fact that it debuted in December was kind of the first step that things were not quite going according to plan, because typically that FAFSA is available around about October. So it was almost 3 months late to become available to students and families and to the higher ed institutions. And, unfortunately, since December, late December, it's just been kind of a series of both glitches with the website and with the technology that students and families are accessing, but also there's been a number of processing errors. The new system is set up to facilitate, hopefully, a lot more sharing of information between the IRS and the Department of Education. And again, all of this was meant to sort of streamline the process, make it run more smoothly, make it easier for students and families to navigate. But unfortunately, in this first year of the rollout, that's not how it's worked. And there's been a lot of issues also with the IRS sharing information with the Department of Education. And that's really resulted in a lot of delays, a lot of headaches for students, families, and the higher ed institutions. We've heard, anecdotally stories about families having to revisit applications over and over and over again to provide the same information over and over again that they already submitted, things like that that have really created a lot of headaches for individuals who have been trying to navigate the process.
We're talking about the disproportionate impact of the federal aid form, the FAFSA delays on Wisconsin students, with Mark Sommerhauser. He's communications director and a policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, out with a new report. Mark, the portion of Wisconsin students applying for federal student aid has been decreasing for years, according to your report. So how does Wisconsin's FAFSA completion rate this year compared to that of the rest of the country?
Yeah, so the answer is that it's lower than most other states. It's as of through April, with the data that we were looking at through April, Wisconsin was ranking 35th among the states. That's not, surprising. It's more or less in line with where we've been at least the last few years. There are different approaches that different school districts and different states take toward FAFSA completion. There are some districts, even here in Wisconsin, that do require FAFSA completion prior to graduation. I believe there are some states that actually require that at a statewide level. And so I think if you look at some of the states that have higher completion rates, obviously you'd see a greater representation of those states that have, whether it's requirements or just other measures in place to try to, get more students to complete the FAFSA. Obviously, it's never going to be anywhere close to 100% because you're never going to have all students going toward higher ed completion. And so that's where some of the pushback might come toward, a requirement. But, but we do see a lot of variation just among the states in those completion rates.
Despite this push, you write about how the FAFSA delays could have Wisconsin colleges and universities seeing lower freshman enrollment for the next school year. Which colleges might feel this enrollment drop the most?
That's a great question. I think it's difficult to speculate, so I want to be careful there. But I think, it's probably fair to say that some of the private colleges and universities might see a little more of an impact. Many of them do have a higher tuition. And so those might be, but many of them offer a lot of financial aid to diffuse that cost for students. But if students are still waiting to get their FAFSA information processed and get it back and get it to the, let's say, a private college or university that they selected, and they're not having that information when they're trying to make a decision about what college to commit to, I think it's very easy to see how that might cause a student and a family to opt for maybe a second or a third option that they know is going to be a little more affordable, rather than, you know, take the risk of committing to a college or university not knowing, you know, what financial aid they might qualify for. So, you know, I think that there's certainly a possibility that it could play out that way, but, you know, it's difficult to say for sure.
UW-Madison, you know, pushed back its commitment deadline from May 1st to May 15th. That new deadline, of course, has passed. What can students do now if they're still facing troubles applying for federal financial aid?
Yeah, so I think the important thing that we want to get across, and I know the other, you know, stakeholders want to try to get across, is that there is still time to complete FAFSA forms. It's true that some colleges and universities have seen commitment deadlines pass, but you know, many of these institutions are going to still be accepting enrollees. The commitment deadlines are typically a date by which, you know, if a financial aid package is offered to a student, they're asked to accept it by that time. But, you know, many of these colleges and universities are going to be continuing to enroll students past those deadlines. And so, you know, if you have any listeners here who have perhaps tried to navigate the FAFSA process, encountered some hurdles, been discouraged, I think the thing to emphasize here is there is still time. You know, students can still fill these out, submit them. Again, many of these institutions will be enrolling students even into the summer months. And we include a few, you know, resources in our report that do provide support for folks that are trying to navigate what, you know, admittedly has been a very difficult process. There are a couple of just organizations and websites that we mentioned in our report that are good resources for families.
Mark, thank you so much for the update.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate.
Mark Sommerhauser is Communications Director and a Policy Researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We've been talking about the revamped federal aid form and a decline in Wisconsin students filling out their FAFSA.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today, and when you're looking for top news from around the state, check out WPR's podcast called Wisconsin Today Morning News.
It's available now. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, amid student demonstrations over the war in Gaza, university administrators try to strike a balance facing demands to divest from companies with ties to Israel. We learn how this time compares to the movement against South African apartheid that gained momentum in Wisconsin decades ago. That's up next on WPR. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the protests over the war in Gaza, a rallying cry on college campuses here in Wisconsin and around the country has been for universities to withdraw investment funds in companies with ties to Israel.
Decades ago, another student-led movement, one positioned against apartheid South Africa, was able to bring about divestments from companies associated with that government, including from the Madison Common Council, Dane County, and the UW Board of Regents.
We turn now to people who experienced and helped shape this anti-apartheid movement in Madison and in other parts of the country and world. We have three guests joining us. Prexy Nesbitt is a Madison-based educator, activist, and scholar on Africa, foreign policy, and racism. Gay Seidman is the Bascom Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison with campus affiliations in African studies.
And Bill Minter is an activist and scholar on Africa, editing a Substack blog called Africa Focus Notes. In the early 1970s, Bill earned a doctorate in sociology and African studies at UW-Madison, following 2 years teaching in the School of the Mozambique Liberation Front in Tanzania.
Bill, let's start with you. How did Madison become this hotspot for early anti-apartheid movement decades ago?
Well, I think it was because of who it attracted. There was a key group. It had a program in African languages and literature, and among the scholars attracted to that were exiled South Africans, Daniel Kunene and his wife, Selena, and A.C. Jordan and his wife, Phyllis. These were two of the most distinguished scholars and linguists of South Africa, of Black South Africa. There were also people there such as Wandile Kuse, an Episcopal priest, also a South African exile. All of these people were involved in the liberation struggle in South Africa, were in exile, but were going to do what they could to support the struggle back home. At the same time, there was also there Dave Wiley, who was then professor of sociology, and his wife, Marilee Cross.
So it feels like South Africa wasn't a world away. There was a community here that was very much in tune with what was happening. I just want to turn to Prexy here. Can you tell a little bit about your connection to what was happening in Madison at this time?
Well, I have a Fox Lake and Beaver Dam connection. My family had a co-op in Fox Lake and Beaver Dam. There were not a lot of Black families in Fox Lake and Beaver Dam. But we used to come regularly just to get a little relief from the cows here to Madison. And then I knew a number of people who were either at Madison or Northwestern, all doing African studies. So I got involved with Bill and with the Madison Area Committee on Southern Africa because I had worked professionally for the American Committee on Africa based out of New York. I had also been in Dar es Salaam. That's how then I got to know the Seidman family and got involved with helping to build consciousness around Southern Africa and about the struggle against apartheid and the struggle against colonialism and racism. So I was all over the region speaking all the time because I was working for the American Committee on Africa.
Educating and really trying to help people understand.
Trying to raise the awareness, make it an issue. And people were very receptive, generally.
And one thing that should be added is that we were all concerned with Southern Africa, not just South Africa.
Gay, your involvement with this movement came a little bit later than Bill and Prexy. How did you first get into this work?
Well, I would say that it's that I'm a little younger. Actually, my mother was on Bill's master's committee at the University of Wisconsin because I lived here in between living in Ghana and Tanzania. By the time I was in college in the mid-70s, at the same time it was beginning to emerge as a major issue in Wisconsin, there was a growing sort of sense that nothing was working, and the governments in the West were refusing to impose sanctions on South Africa. There was South Africa and the Portuguese colonies, Mozambique and Angola, and there was Rhodesia, were this belt of countries around South Africa, and all of them were run by white minority rule or colonial rule. So there was this sense of we need to make people aware of South Africa and looking at, particularly for campuses, looking at the university's investments in companies that did business in South Africa was a way to raise an awareness of it's far away, your life is not directly affected by it, but you are involved.
Divestment is now such a word that we're hearing all over college campuses in Wisconsin and beyond. How did divestment emerge as really a tool, as leverage for anti-apartheid?
I think that one of the things that's not talked about enough is that the divestment movement has deep roots. And so many of the people that were in Africa, for example, I was in Tanzania in 65. When I came back to Antioch College, I raised the issue of our involvement with companies involved with South Africa. So in 67... we had a sit-in at Antioch College, and we took over the Board of Trustees meeting. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And then we modeled that at other campuses all over so that the roots of concern with particularly ridding ourselves of apartheid and at the same time making a contribution to the struggle against apartheid are very deep in this country.
And very deep here in Madison.
Absolutely.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here for a moment as we explore the history of the anti-apartheid movement in Madison and divestment from South Africa's apartheid regime that took off really in the 1980s. We're looking more deeply back in that history. And as college students in Wisconsin and around the country have called for their universities to divest from Israel in protest of the war in Gaza, we have Prexy Nesbitt with us, a Madison-based educator, activist, and scholar on Africa. Gay Seidman, a UW-Madison sociology professor. And Bill Minter is here, an Africa scholar and was an anti-apartheid activist during his graduate work at UW-Madison in the early 70s. Bill, could you talk about the importance of networks in the organizing you did in building the anti-apartheid movement in Madison and really making those connections?
Well, I think the importance of networks is general in social movements. Even more important than organizations. That was true in the civil rights movement, in which I was involved as a part of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Mm-hmm. And it's also true internationally that organizational and movement links are based on personal networks. And I think you can see the three of us as an illustration of that. A lot of those came together in Madison. It meant, for example, that when spokespeople from the liberation movements visited the United States, their visits were often coordinated by the American Committee on Africa and the Africa Fund in New York City that used contacts around the country to set up speaking tours. So Chicago, during the period that I was in Wisconsin, 69 to 73, Prexy was a node for those visits, and I was in Madison, and there were other people in other places around the country.
Yeah. I wonder, too, you know, we've been seeing and hearing of the encampments gay. And during this era of the anti-apartheid movement, there and I'm not sure at what point in these decades, but there were these shantytown protests where people setting up encampments on public lands. Can you draw any parallels there? What was the implications?
Actually, first of all, Madison didn't have a shantytown because it actually was a real pathbreaker in some ways. It was the first university that actually managed to move the needle. So many universities, there had been sit-ins and protests demanding divestment. Many students around the country had gotten really... Actually, I remember when I was in college in, I believe it was 1970. So it was 1976. It was after the Soweto Uprising when students really got involved. I remember, because I was on the student paper at my college, we ran a headline.
And this is at Harvard.
This was at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And the headline in the paper, I wrote the article, Stanford's students arrested for divestment may start national trend. I feel like Cassandra. The Madison campus, they did have a sit-in, but even more importantly, because unlike most college towns, there's the Capitol down the street. Yeah. The students were able to persuade some Wisconsin legislatures to pass a law saying that Wisconsin public entities could not invest in companies related linked to apartheid, which was amazing. It was the first major victory for the divestment movement.
Was that proximity, or how could you see that movement there to politics?
Nobody predicted it. I mean, everyone is completely surprised because nobody would have thought that Wisconsin would have been the first place. But this amazing, I attribute it to the people who were here as students who figured out that this was an option and they found someone who would promote the bill.
Actually, in terms of, I think the divestment by the university system came before the state divestment. And that was the work of La Follette.
I was referring to La Follette's bill. I'm sorry.
The Attorney General at the time, Bronson La Follette. Yeah. Okay, yeah. You mentioned the Soweto Uprising. I want to turn to Prexy for this. How significant was the 1976 Soweto Uprising in breathing life into this movement and what was happening in Madison?
Oh, it was tremendously important and ignited not just Madison, but ignited movements across the whole country. Because I think the other thing to bear in mind here is that the relationship between the struggle in South Africa and the struggle for civil rights and change here in the United States was a profound relationship. And so many of the South Africans who came and studied here got immediately very involved. Bill Minter named a number of people who were here in Madison. Those people all got very involved also in the civil rights struggle related here in this country. And so that I would say that from the late 60s onwards, there was tremendous awareness of, and Soweto absolutely kicked it off entirely. I mean, I can remember going around Chicago, because I was organizing in Chicago and in the Midwest and over the country. And I can remember people saying to me, I'm watching this stuff, these children being shot down. Mm-hmm. Can we get them something? Can we get, what do they need? Because it was, and ultimately the South African government figured out that they had to make sure that this stopped being broadcast the way it was in this country.
At Harvard, the same thing happened. We had a group of about four people who were in the anti-apartheid movement, and then the Soweto, because we started like the year before. Mm-hmm. We got to, my twin sister and I were in college together. But then
I think one of the key things was that there was an information base built up so that when Soweto happened, it actually emerged for the first time as a major TV news story. And in that case, the groups that had been building to provide information, actually in the period 69 that I was in Madison, not much attention to Africa. All the protest was about Vietnam.
Yeah.
But we were building an information infrastructure that when the TV got there and began covering it, then those groups that had been working beforehand sort of quietly in terms of educating people could actually begin to take action.
Okay, what parallels and or perhaps contrast can you draw in the coverage and the impact of on the anti-apartheid movement versus what we're seeing now with the protests over Gaza?
That's a really interesting question because one of the things I've been really struck by is that during the anti-apartheid demonstrations, there were no counter-protesters. And one of the really striking things now is that on campuses across the country, there are these counter-protesters. I've been present at some of the demonstrations here at the encampment, and I've been shocked by the aggressiveness of the counter-protesters, actually, almost trying to provoke a fight, no one was going to defend apartheid in the United States. The police would, like, happily shepherd us off campus but there was no effort to provoke. Here it feels like a very different dynamic. On the other hand, what's much more similar than I expected, you can see in the in the encampment here in Madison, the same kind of networking that Bill was talking about, the same kind of people, often people who don't know very much about the issue coming to the encampment at these teach-ins and learning more about human rights rules or rules of war or the refugee system. These teach-ins have been amazing, and you can see students becoming aware of the world in a different way, which I remember that happening in the anti-apartheid movement as well.
Prexy, I want to land here on education, which was so important for you as well in the anti-apartheid movement. What would you tell the students today who are out there protesting the war in Gaza?
I think it's critical for them to remember the roots of these struggles and the connectivity between these struggles. At root, one of the things that's behind the Palestinian struggle is the statement of the South Africans of total identity and solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. And I think that's one of the things that has fueled particularly African Americans and many Americans of color and working class Americans have been fueled by the solidarity. The South Africans were one of the first to make a major statement that comes out of the long history of relationship between the African National Congress and the Palestinian movements.
Praxi, you're referring to the international court case that they brought, right, the South African
case. I was referring more, though, to them bringing the case more recently.
Yes,
yes. But the roots of that, them bringing it, go back to the relationship they had going way back as a liberation movement and a liberation struggle. And my experience in South Africa has been that the mobilization by South Africans in South Africa against Zionism and against the right wing and the fascist support of brutality and racism has been very much a part of what today is also happening. It's a learning process. These struggles are learning processes.
Thank you all for sharing this history. Thank you for joining us, Gay, Praxi, and Bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Minter is an activist and scholar in Africa, editing a Substack blog called Africa Focused Notes. Praxi Nesbitt is a Madison-based educator, activist, and scholar on Africa, foreign policy, and racism. And Gay Seidman is a sociology professor at UW-Madison. We talked with them about their connections to the anti-apartheid movement in Madison and student activism now over Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza.
Coming up, a Milwaukee musician says country music is for everybody. Meet Andre Lamar, also known as the Black Country Singer.
I love the way the country stories would evoke emotion and make me feel a certain way.
That's coming up here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we have a story from Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum on one of the most prolific songwriting duos who happen to have Wisconsin roots.
Wisconsin isn't typically thought of as being the heart of country music, but did you know that half of one of the greatest songwriting duos is from Milwaukee? As Justin Barney tells us, Felice and Budalo Bryant are members of the Country Music Hall of Fame and co-wrote Rocky Top, the state song of Tennessee. But first, they met in a dream in Milwaukee.
I'm standing in an elevator in the Hilton Hotel in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And in this elevator, one of the greatest love stories in all of music happened. In 1945, Matilda Scududo worked in this elevator. She was a 19-year-old Sicilian girl in Milwaukee. And one day, Budalo Bryant, a touring musician, got onto this elevator. And as he walked on, she said, "I've been looking for you." She had been seeing Budalo Bryant in her dreams. And here he was, in front of her. He was charmed. Who wouldn't be? It was love at first sight. 5 days later, they got married. In 1950, they moved to Nashville, Tennessee.
And they lived in a trailer.
That's Paul Kingsbury. He works at the Country Music Hall of Fame.
In Nashville, Tennessee.
In their honeymoon phase, they wrote this little song together.
I'm a plain old country boy.
And it became a hit.
They were essentially the first full-time professional songwriters in Nashville.
They were songwriters, not performers, which meant that they had to sell their songs then to musicians, which is difficult. But the Bryants were smart, and they cooked up a little scheme. They invited musicians into that trailer of theirs.
And Felice would cook a wonderful Italian dinner. Maybe it was spaghetti and meatballs. Maybe it was chicken cacciatore. Then Boudreaux would break out his guitar and sing their latest songs. And inevitably, the people who came in, they were charmed. And often the Bryants got a recording out of that. They did it enough times that Felice liked to refer to it as their pasta scam.
Things really took off when they sold this song to the Everly Brothers.
Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry.
The Everly Brothers said they would have been working manual labor jobs if it hadn't been for the Bryants coming along with that song and several of the other hits they wrote for the Everlys.
And right they did. Over 1,000 songs with hundreds recorded by some of the biggest names in music history.
Elvis Presley, Ray Charles, and Bob Dylan. The Beatles. Paul McCartney has said, you know, he felt like the Bryants and the Everlys were a big influence on what he and John Lennon and the Beatles were trying to do.
And they wrote some iconic songs like this one.
I think what makes a Bryant song is that it's not belabored and it's clever. They had a way of telling 3-minute stories where you felt like, oh, I know exactly what's going on.
The Bryants' love story and their musical accomplishments and legacy is the kind of stuff of dreams. And, in fact, it started with Felice meeting the literal man of her dreams in an elevator. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Dream, 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 dream.
They wrote this song, one of their biggest, about that dream.
Justin Barney is a radio host and Wisconsin native who currently works at WNXP in Nashville. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
This ain't Texas. This ain't Texas, so we'll still lay our cards down. Country music is often seen as the music of rural white America.
But when we dig beyond the stereotypes, country music has a rich history that owes a lot to African Americans who were enslaved in the United States. Among other contributions to American music, they created the banjo and pioneered narrative storytelling and ballads.
Beyoncé is among a new generation of black Americans who are revisiting the genre. Beyoncé's latest album, Cowboy Carter, became the first by a black woman to hit number one on Billboard's country charts.
She joins a long list of black artists who have recorded country songs through the decades. Think Solomon Burke, Tina Turner, Charlie Pride, Rhiannon Giddens, Darius Rucker, and Ray Charles.
Add Milwaukee's Andre Lamar to that list. He records and performs as the black country singer. Andre, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Milwaukee. Andre, I understand you sang in your church's gospel choir and high school choir. When did you first start to encounter seriously country music?
My first introduction to country music, actually, it was a story that, you know, kind of, I guess, yeah, it's a story. But after high school, I went to Mesmer High School. After high school, I actually went the wrong way and got in trouble with the law. And was placed in a situation where the guards, all they played was country music. Growing up in the 53206 zip code, the chances that you're going to hear country music before you're 18 are very slim. So this is my first introduction. I can't say that I was a big fan right away, but I've always been a fan of lyrics and I've always been a fan of storytelling. So that's what hooked me.
I think some people just plain don't like country music, at least at first. Talk a little more about what it was that made you warm up to country music.
I think first I'll talk about what kind of kept me away. It was some of the sounds that I wasn't used to hearing, mm-hmm. you know, like the steel guitar or the banjo or, you know, even electric guitar. It's very rare that you would hear that in today's music and, you know, African-American music. So those sounds kind of kept me away from it, and I wasn't used to hearing them. But once I started really focusing in on the stories and hearing how the music flowed with the stories, I think that's what just kind of kept me drawn in. And I love the way the country stories would evoke emotion and make me feel a certain way.
And you're a music guy. What is it that made you say, okay, I like listening to it now. I'm going to try playing something in kind of a country feel.
I've always been a storyteller, and I've always been a writer. So it was my first country song that I wrote called High Life, where I started writing the lyrics almost being funny. And, you know, something just clicked in that moment, and I finished writing those lyrics, and I sang that song for a couple people, and everybody enjoyed it, and they loved the writing. So that's what made me say, you know what, I can do this. I can pursue this, and I can tell stories. You know, there's no difference between the stories. It's just how they're presented.
Well, let's hear a little bit now. This is one of your songs. This is from back in 2014. I've been pretty popular online. The song is called Gone Fishing.
For some reason she seems to please. I'm leaving. There's something I'm missing when I'm gone fishing.
Andre, what was the inspiration behind Gone Fishing?
Gone Fishing is, you know, it's the story of a man who's not paying attention. And life is just passing him by. And before he knows it, everything's changed and he doesn't even realize it. And his woman's gone because she's not happy. And, you know, it's just the idea of being gone fishing. You know, when you go to a place and they have the sign on the door that says, I'm gone fishing, mm-hmm. be back in 10 minutes. But it's the idea that you're not on duty. You're not paying attention to life.
But as I listen to the song, I feel like the guy in the song, he's out fishing. He's still kind of enjoying life despite the bad stuff going on.
Right. Or he's just oblivious to it. So, you know, one thing is to be oblivious to it, and another thing is to be able to smile through it. So, yeah, I agree. But this guy, I think he's more so oblivious to what's going on.
And did you go fishing at some point in your life? Was that part of your story too?
I love fishing. My dad was an avid fisherman, and I grew up fishing. That's how we were raised, so, you know, understanding the whole idea of baiting your hook and throwing it out there and seeing what you get. I love it.
Andre Lamar of Milwaukee is with us. He records as the Black country singer. It's no secret, Andre, people think often of country music as white music. Been that way in many ways for decades. What kind of reaction do you get from audiences, black or white, for that matter, saying, hey, wait a minute, this is country music. This is a black performer. Does it strike people? Do you get those double takes?
I do. And I still appreciate it even to this day. I've been singing country music for a long time, so I love the fact that it's more popular today than it's ever been. And, you know, but I've been doing it so long that before it was popular, of course, a lot of people would, you know, say, hey, you know, what are you doing singing country music, or how did that happen? There's always the need to want to know why or how. And that's what I always try to kind of break that myth and say, there's no need to know why. It's just what I'm doing. It just is. the same way Eminem can, you know, be the number one selling rap artist of all time.
When I read up on country music history, Andre, it seems like every generation, every decade, there are black country music performers. Black people in America did so many things, like, you know, bring the banjo into the game, so much stuff that made country music happen. Why do you think that this whole genre just became so identified with white performers and white fans?
Well, you would have to honestly pay attention to the industry, because the people who control these sounds are the people who actually, you know, get to control the narrative. So if I'm an artist who never gets the opportunity to be heard, then, you know, but someone else might get more of an opportunity just based on their skin color. And honestly, that's why I went back to school after, you know, going the wrong way and dealing with incarceration. After that is when I decided to get a marketing degree and start my own label, my own publishing, and be able to help other artists as well to discover their voice and be able to place their voice somewhere where it can be heard.
Oh, I want to check out another one of your songs. This is a newer one now. It's called Been Around. You released it this year with Steve Hibicki, a producer known as The Sauce. Here's a little taste of The Sauce. Andre, I love the drop here. It's a straightforward country. Then we got some electronic beat. Tell us some more about the song.
This song is... I like this song because it came together pretty quick. Steve reached out to me with the idea and he put the instrumental together, and I approached it with a, you know, just I wanted to really put some emotion into this song, and it was a fun song to do. And I'm looking forward to doing the visuals for it really, really soon.
And as we wrap up, Andre, I mean, we've been talking about country music. You're clearly influenced by a lot of other genres as well. Do we lose something when we just put these like really hard and fast lines saying, you know, that's country, that's pop, that's soul, whatever?
Yes, we definitely lose something, because all music genres have morphed over time. They're not today what they were 10 years ago. So we have to take in the account of evolution, and things are going to change, and we have to be open to it, because as we, as a people, change and we age and the younger ones age, the way they express is going to change, and doesn't mean that the words that they're saying are less important.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your music with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you guys.
That's Milwaukee musician Andre Lamar. He performs and records as the Black Country Singer. Find some song recommendations from Andre at WPR.org. If you like big trees and you cannot lie, here's an outdoor activity for you: big tree hunting. People around the world do this thing where they quest to find the biggest trees they can.
It's become a competitive hobby. Rob, it's a thing. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk to Wisconsin big tree hunters next week on Wisconsin Today.
And we want to hear from you if you have done this, if you're a big tree hunter, or if you have a favorite forest, maybe even a favorite tree in your yard or your neighborhood. Tell us about it.
Leave us a message right now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can email us as well.
We're pining to hear from you, so don't leave us in the lurch.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.